Dear listeners, this episode is being brought to you by the medium of technology. We're all in different places this time, so bear with us as we embark upon the Linux Voice Podcast, Series 2, Episode 11. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison. Was I supposed to go at that point?
I think we said we were going to do it alphabetically, didn't we? So if we're using the Latin alphabet, then... by the way, somebody on Reddit complained about one of us laughing too much. So we've got to be really, really sad and serious in this podcast. Just think of like crying kittens and things like that.
Okay.
Because Reddit's always sad and serious.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
Yes, that's what we were waiting for. The magic of Mike introducing himself before we can really begin the Linux Voice Podcast Series 2, Episode 11 in earnest. Still to come on this feature-packed sound wave. there's news. We don't have any voices to mass.
No, we don't have any neurons to vocalise.
Sorry, that's right. We have a voice for the masses. News, finds, things that we found in a fortnight. Mm-hmm. And there might even be a halfway reminder in there at some point, if you're good. If you like that sort of thing, but on paper, or even on PDFs on Electrons that are guaranteed paper-free, you can subscribe to Linux Voice at shop.linuxvoice.com. And
which is well worth doing, because we deliver 115 pages of fun and games like this every month.
Better than this.
Oh yes, better than this. More carefully planned than this.
Yeah, we should do that actually, shouldn't we? The planning bit.
One day. For now, though, it's time for news, isn't it?
Oh, news. That's me. Right, first up in the news this fortnight, our top item for Linux is there's now 500 games on Steam. 500!
That is amazing. That is amazing. It was only a few months ago, it was like 200 or 250 or something.
Yeah, I remember when there was 100 games and I was like, I'll never get many more than this, that's loads.
I remember when there was the almost daily rumours, is Steam coming to Linux one day? Will this be the day?
Yes, it's excellent. It's E3 at the moment as well, so just as fitting, although I haven't seen any Linux announcements yet, which is a big games conference.
So 500 games. I think on that basis alone, we can say Linux is a gaming platform now. You know, ages ago it was like, well, you can't really play games on Linux. I can't imagine playing 500 games. I'm still playing Mario Kart on the SNES. So you know, for me, 500 games is like enough for... when I retire and if I get some sort of longevity spell cast on me.
That's 500 games for Steam. There's still NetHack as well.
Well, of course, actually. And NetHack is, as we know, the world's best video game. And I believe it's covered in Linux Voice issue 5, which has just gone to press.
Does it count as a video game when it's all text?
It goes through a visual display unit. I guess.
So, what, your eyes?
I don't know if you could play. You couldn't really play it on a teletype terminal. Well, you could, but it would have to keep printing the whole dungeon each time. I will contact the developers and ask them that.
Yeah, I think Linux has become a legitimate games platform. I mean, it's missing the AAA titles that lots of people want to see, and hopefully that will come. But, I mean, 500 games, that's enough for 500 lifetimes worth of playing. It's just brilliant.
Graham, has David Braben said whether or not Elite Dangerous is going to come to Linux?
I don't think he said anything about it for about 9 months when he did say that it's unlikely to happen. So I don't know. If there's going to be an OS X port, I mean, an OS X version coming a couple of months after the Windows version, and we know that OS X doesn't demand that much more extra development than the Linux version, so potentially.
Exactly, yeah, if they're already making it portable between Windows and Linux, then Windows and OS X, then yeah, well, we can hope.
Okay, next up in the news, Kim.com. That's a scary thought. Kiwi entrepreneur and mega uploader has offered, he's been being hauled through the courts after a raid on its property because of alleged privacy infringements being had on Mega Upload, his service. He's claiming that that was an entirely politically orchestrated raid because of agreements between the Obama administration and the and Hollywood, basically.
It did seem massively out of proportion for, you know, what he'd allegedly done.
I think you mean comically out of proportion.
Well, Kim Kong is comically out of proportion.
Yeah, it was one of those really sort of surreal things with the videos of the SWAT team jumping in and just to turn off some servers.
And it's quite surreal that he's become kind of some defender of internet freedoms.
Yeah. But, yeah, specifically the news item this week is that he's offered $5 million for anyone who can, any whistleblowers who can come out and provide evidence to show that this was a politically orchestrated attack rather than a sort of illegal proper process thingy.
Can't we just say, Mike, you did it. And then, you know, for $100 million, surely you could go to prison for a couple of years.
It depends on which country, yeah.
Yeah. Mike stands up and says, Obama told me to do it. We pocket $1.25 million each.
Oh, no, hang on. That's dollars. It's I've just had a look. New Zealand dollars is only 51p each.
Yeah.
Is he offering New Zealand dollars?
I don't know. I assume so, because he's from New Zealand.
I thought he was offering American dollars because he wanted Americans to come forward.
I don't know. We've just implanted our own, you know, cultural hegemonic shifts on there.
Yeah.
Also, isn't he American? Isn't he... He's not a native of New Zealand, is he?
Oh, right. And they put the servers in the Shire because he thought they'd be safe there from the white hand of Saruman.
The Guardian has it in pounds, and they say it's 3 million of the Queen's finest pounds.
That
so that'll put
like
it as American.
American dollars, then.
He's German slash Finnish, according to Wikipedia.
What, you're saying he's an international man of mystery?
He's slightly scary, so I really like him.
No laughter.
Let's get on to some vaguely more computery seriousy news. The Turing test has apparently been passed. I'm not sure. I mean, I sort of read that some computer apparently can emulate a 13-year-old Ukrainian child. Mike, yes.
Well, I've actually tried the bot. I actually found it and had a conversation with it. And like you say, it's basically a chatbot that has been able to convince a third of a jury that it is a real person, because the threshold to pass the Turing test is just convincing 30% of people. So it's not that high. And here's an example of, I only managed to ask it two questions because it was massively under load. My first question was, what is the weather like in Ukraine? Bit of a silly question because the country's so huge. But his response was, in my native town, people says that meteorologists are like sappers. They make a mistake only once, but the difference is that sappers do that once in a lifetime and meteorologists daily. Do you like weather today? Okay, not very good. So I said, do you want to stay in Ukraine? He said, Ukraine is a former republic of the Soviet Union. Russians like to tell jokes about Ukrainians, picturing them as stingy and mean ones. I mean, it only took me a few questions to realize that. I mean, I knew it was a chatbot anyway, yeah. But it really wasn't convincing. And it's basically got away with it by setting a very, I don't say low standard, but something that's easy to emulate. You've got a 13-year-old boy, so he won't know that much about the world.
But it's very verbose for a 13-year-old boy. Every teenager I've spoken to recently would just answer in single syllables.
Well, that's true, yeah. But I think it's quite an easy thing to do. You just make it a bit quirky and weird. It's not a gigantic AI breakthrough like all the rubbish mass media is reporting on it. Wow, this is it. This is the future. It's just a chatbot that's quite good at some things and quite bad at others. It's no different to Eliza in Emacs.
So there's a jury. Who picks the jury?
This was done by the Royal Society, wasn't it?
The Royal Society picked the jury.
It was like Crichton from Red Dwarf and some other people. It was entirely arbitrary. They weren't selected for their cunning AI-ness.
Right. So, but I mean, if you want to, if you want to determine the outcome of a trial, then it makes sense to pick the jury. So, if it was, for example, if it was an institution that wanted to provide some cheap headlines for itself, it might just pick people who had never spoken English before, or had never interacted with humans.
Yes.
That's all.
I haven't had the chance to try it, but from what Mike says, if it's failing so utterly dreadfully, it's a bit of a shock that it's being reported as a pass.
Well, that really is the story, isn't it? I mean, I've seen a screenshot of the conversation, and it's laughable that 33% of any group of English speakers would think that it was natural language. It just looks like it's... But this press release seems to have been copied and pasted into the BBC and The Guardian and otherwise reputable news sources. The thing a couple of weeks ago about, there's a virus and now you've got two weeks to save the Earth. You've got 2 weeks to do something. What do we do? Oh, no, I don't know. Oh, it turns out that it's from, you know, Kaspersky or somewhere, and the thing that you have to do is buy lots of antivirus software. Just the level of reporting of technology and, well, technology is baffling in fairness, but computers and stuff, it's no wonder that people think it's a scary black box.
Well, having in the last couple of days seen a major internet news site do an interview with Linus Torvalds, the creator of the Linux programming language, I'm already completely despondent. So.
Mike, don't you mean Linux Torvalds?
Oh, yes, Linux Torvalds, as somebody else called him, but let's not get into that.
Okay, I think we've debated that quite thoroughly. Should we move on to something perhaps a little less controversial? Quitter, the drawing app. I don't quite know how to describe it, because it's more than... It's not like GIMP for like editing pictures. It is for actually drawing and creating art on a computer. They had a Kickstarter. They just launched a Kickstarter to make making art on computers even more wonderful. I don't know if any of you guys tried it. I did it for a review a few months ago. And it's actually... It's unlike any of the other drawing applications I've used. I haven't used that many. And it is... It took a little while to get used to, but it is actually quite nice and for illustrating and...
Yeah, I think it's an excellent application, and it's often really underrated. Sometimes, you know, it's forgotten about, but it's a really decent drawing application. It's got CMYK support and really nice layer support. It's got a lovely GUI, and I think they're after something like €15,000.
Yeah, it's quite a small amount,
and there's something like 29 features or something like that that they'll pay to a developer to develop.
Yeah, they're going to do a feature every 2 weeks for 6 months.
I don't know if you know, Ben, but there's a free half-page advert for this kickstarting campaign in the Linux Voice issue 5.
When
they got in touch with us, so it seemed like a good idea. It seems like a great use of, you know, any spare space we may have.
Our last piece of Linux news this fortnight is Docker 1.1 releases. 1.0, so yes. It's just come out. This is following shortly on from the Linux Containers 1.0 release. I don't know, about a month or so ago, is it? Maybe 2 months? So again, it's for it's deploying cloudy stuff really easily.
I think it's interesting that people talk about how awesome Docker is, that you can use it to quickly fire up a Linux setup to test or build your project on. So you can quickly say, boom, there's an Ubuntu 12.04 installation, or boom, there's CentOS 6, so I can test my software. But on the other hand, that sort of suggests, well, wouldn't it be better if there were more standards across these Linux distributions and you didn't have to test everything across this plethora of different distros? I mean, I'm not exactly sure what the state of the LSB, the Linux standards base, is these days, but I had a lot of hopes back in the day that it would help this.
But the big advantage to Docker is... Sorry, Andrew.
I was just going to suggest that Mike appears to have diverted from the orthodoxy that choice is good and he should be sent to room 101 for immediate re-education.
I need breakfast cereals quickly.
The big advantage of Docker is that you can split up your test machine from your deployment machine. So if you were to run a Ubuntu server cloud and you happen to like Arch as your desktop machine, you can develop on Arch with Docker and you can spin it out to test it. And yeah, you could say there should be these standards, but no one is going to test on an Arch machine and then just deploy to an Ubuntu server without testing it fully.
That's true. That's a fair point, yeah.
And also, you know, switching providers or whatnot, it allows you to fully encapsulate it. And obviously, choice is good. And that's the news.
Excellent. I say that every single time.
Let's just see if we can get through this section without saying the dreaded word that always gets mentioned on Twitter. Let's try it, guys. We can do it.
It's really good that you reminded me because I was just about to make the mistake. It's time for Finds of the Fortnight.
I thought the dreaded word was awesome, man.
That is quite dreaded.
I really like that challenge when we were challenged not to say awesome. We should do some easy challenges like that. That was a good section. I know we've all been insanely busy the last couple of weeks. I have one discovery, which isn't bad. But does anyone else want to go first?
Oh, do you realise what you just said?
What?
I can't say the word, obviously. But
I'm terrible.
Minus one to Graham.
I'm so disappointed with myself. I'm feeling old if I can't reprogram my brain to just say one thing instead of another.
Oh well, I'll try and blur out this horrible memory by talking about my find. I've actually got two. The first one relates to something that Ben and I were talking about. I think in the last podcast, or maybe quite a bit off microphone, about taste in space. Ben, you were saying that food doesn't taste so good for astronauts because their noses tend to be blocked and stuff. Is that right?
Yeah, because there's no gravity. The mucus doesn't drain out of the sinuses like it would on Earth. It just builds up because a huge amount of taste is sort of linked into the smell and all that sort of thing. They have quite a low amount of taste.
Right, that makes sense. I read somewhere that Tabasco sauce is really popular on the International Space Station for this reason. But just a few days ago, I came across a scientific paper called The Effect of Background Noise on Food Perception. And here's a quote from it. We investigated the effects of auditory background noise on the perception of gustatory food properties, sugar level and salt level, food crunchiness and food liking. Participants blindly consumed different foods whilst passively listening to either no sound or quiet or loud background white noise. The foods were then rated in terms of sweetness, saltiness and liking, or in terms of overall flavour, crunchiness and liking. Reported sweetness and saltiness was significantly lower in the loud compared to the quiet sound food conditions, but crunchiness was reported to be more intense. So your food should
Sorry, Mike,
be...
I just drifted away there. What was the point?
If your biscuits are stale, turn your music up.
Your food should be crunchier when you're on an airplane, or at least you should perceive it to be crunchier. Okay. Maybe, you know, when they give you a bag of nuts and stuff, then it's worth noting that.
I'm sure.
I believe the problem with taste on an airplane is because the air is very dry and it does a similar thing to in space, but in a different way, because it dries out all your sinuses. You aren't as receptive to the smell and the taste in the same way. So okay. If you want to do the Heston Blumenthal thing, you squirt salt water up your nose first before eating.
Can you do that on a plane when they not think you're a bit dodgy?
If you do it anywhere, they'll think you're a bit dodgy, to be honest.
As long as it's less than 100 mils, you're safe.
Well, you could cry into a small little cup.
Or take some salt with you and ask for water.
Yeah, take a small packet of salt onto a plane.
Yeah, just fold it up into some tinfoil.
But my other find is actually related to Linux and Unix, just to keep this podcast moderately on topic.
Did you say UKIP? This
Unix, not Linux and UKIP. I'm not going to go that off topic. Now, this find came from a post by Rob Pike, one of the early Unix and Plan 9 developers and the creator of the Go programming language.
You and I interviewed him, remember?
Oh, we did back. God, that was in 2011. It must have been in America,
It was about Go. It was about Go at the time. It was just when Go was beginning to look awesome.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what happened with Go. I don't know how much it's been
used. It's massive. It's very popular. Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah.
I obviously got the wrong sort of job. But yeah, you know how files beginning with dots, files and directories beginning with dots tend to be hidden. That's sort of normal standard Unix, Linux behavior. Well, that wasn't actually intended. When in very early Unix versions, when the developers were introducing the concept of a single dot for the current directory and two dots for the one above, they wanted to prevent LS from showing these directories because normally you've got no reason to see them. You always know that there's a current directory, you're in it. So due to a programming error, a single dot on its own wasn't just hidden, but all files and directories beginning with the dot. So that was just a bug. But over time, this has sort of morphed into a commonly used system to have configuration files and folders in your home directory that you don't normally see unless you do a special, you know, ls-a command. Does that make up for my previous find that was not so Linuxy?
Yeah, that's pretty good.
That's good. Good, Mike. Good skills. Awesome skills.
I too have a Linux-related find for once. It's Zinki. I think that's how you pronounce it. X-I-K-I. It's
These projects really do help themselves, don't they?
It's kind of like a shell thing that goes into a text editor. So if you're in your text editor, for example, I've got it in Vim, and you type in what would look like the line on a shell, so $ls, and then you double click on $ls, it expands to the result of that command.
Right.
So then you can go back if you decide, oh, I want to do ls-a or pipe it into something, you can go and change it, double click on it again, and you get the results. And you can do this anywhere in the text editor, so not just at the bottom, like you could in a regular shell. And you can go back and edit it and sort of chop and change stuff around as you go on.
And so, because, I mean, I know in Vim you can, I think it's with !r, you can read a command input into your current Vim text editing document. But this is, you say this, you can update this on the fly with a new instruction, yeah?
Exactly, yeah. And you can, edit the instruction stays where it is, and then the expansion drops out below it. And you can sort of, it's a little bit hard to explain, to be honest.
I think I get it.
It works a lot better, I believe, with Emacs than it does with Vim, but I didn't want to have to learn Emacs just to try this out. Break my little finger.
I guess you can do it without a mouse.
Yeah, you can do control click rather than double click.
Right.
Although that wasn't working in Vim. Apparently that works in some text editors.
So is it useful for if you're writing something that has these commands in it and you want to check the output as you're writing the documentation?
I mean, I can see it being useful in a few ways. Yeah, one of them is for that. Another one is if you're building a large command and you can sort of check it much easier and re-edit it and whatnot on the fly.
Okay.
Another one, if you're running two or more commands, you know, one after the other, but sort of going back and forwards between them, you can have several commands there. And yeah, you know, you can do that with a history and a shell, but it's quite nice to have them there. And so you can change them and whatnot. It was quite handy.
Yeah.
I've not discovered anything to do with Linux or Unix.
But have you found anything?
Oh, minus one for Andrew.
I can see Paul Gear's face from his Twitter profile rebuking me, shaking his head, looking sad. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I found a thing, which is a book called Mostly Harmless. And it's a sci-fi malarkey set in the universe of
Elite.
Hey!
Frontier.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it's only available for the Kindle, which means that I tried to buy it today, but then realised that I'd just be downloading useless bits. So I've kept my money. I'm probably going to spend it on something else. Oh, well. But that's on the Amazon, and it's by Kate Russell and Heather Murphy. Kate Russell is the person off of the BBC's Click programme.
Like an official elite frontier development book, or
is it a fictional universe? I guess that's what Mike's trying to ask.
It's the universe of frontier and elite. It has,
but yeah, frontier came with that manual, didn't it?
Yeah, I think this has the imprimatur of elite frontier development.
Right. But it's a story surrounding events set in the universe. It's,
yes.
Because did Frontier come with a novella?
It did. It came with a big bunch of short stories, one of which made specific reference to a plasma cannon destroying small planets.
Right.
And I've tried that about a million times, and it doesn't work.
Well, the plasma accelerator in Frontier was actually a massive disappointment because I think the manual itself referenced it being able to destroy space stations.
So that was it.
Yeah, and planets, I think, as well, in the other books. And it's like, we all spent ages saving up to get a Panther clipper and equipping it with this and sitting outside a space station ready to do the most awesome thing in the history of the made-up universe.
500 tons of precious cargo space. Wasted. Yeah.
You click those mouse buttons at the same time and, a few police came out and that was it. So, fail, Robin, fail.
I have no idea what any of you are talking about.
Well, I think we talked before that there was a really good novella that came with Elite. I really enjoyed it. And it kind of set the background story for you being left with 100 credits and a Cobra Mark III at the very beginning. Mm. And you being, you escaped in the escape pod and there's some distant Jedi planet called Raxla. I always wondered, I think there might even have been somebody who wrote a sequel to that.
Was it called The Dark Side?
Yes, that's it. That's it. You're right. Well remembered.
I've never actually read it. Elite was a sort of tiny bit before my time, but I've just heard of it before.
I haven't read it since 1985, so, teenage me probably thought it was great. Teenage me locked up in his bedroom, unable to use the television because they were watching Blankety Blank downstairs.
At the risk of sort of straying onto something less.
Something with Linux in it.
Yeah, you can read Kindle books without a Kindle.
Can you?
Yes. There's apps for it for most platforms. I'm not sure if there's an official Amazon app. There used to be sort of vaguely illegal ways of stripping off the DRM and opening them in Calibre. I'm not sure if that's still possible.
We could ask Effie about that.
It's a very decent Android app. I mean, that works brilliantly. I use it.
And you can read in your browser as well. I think it's reads.amazon.com. I was reading that ARM assembly language book that way. So, yeah, you can read Kindle books in the browser on Linux.
Brilliant. So I can pay to read stuff in a browser.
Yeah. Enjoy DRM. And my discovery.
No! Why, God?
Because I'm just stupid. But my find from a few months ago was the BIP IRC proxy that we've all been using to buffer our IRC conversations when we're not there. And it's worked very well, but there are times when it just completely fails. And it feels a bit flaky. Sometimes it crashes and sometimes I need to restart it. So I've been looking at an alternative the last couple of days, and I've been using it on the IRC channel, even though you can't tell. And it's called ZNC or ZNC, and it's so much better than BIP. So whereas BIP was my original discovery, ZNC is a massive, considerable upgrade on the features that BIP has, and actually a lot easier to configure, mostly because it uses modules. So there's a web admin module, so I'll be able to. We can all add and manage our own buffers through a web interface. It also seems really stable. And what I really like is that the backlog of messages, when you get them sent to your IRC client, they're not preceded by anything. They just come up with the original times that the messages were sent. It also handles DCC transfers. Yeah.
That is really cool. Yeah, because the current one, it prepends something to every line, doesn't it? It's obviously just flowing stuff back. But this looks like you've just it's seamless, I guess, is it now?
Yeah, and I've been logging on and logging off and logging on as I've been working in the garden today, and it's kept up without any problems. So it seems brilliant, actually. It's excellent. And I can't tell you how useful it has been, IRC, to us, I think, and also this kind of bit proxy and the ability to catch up on conversation you've missed. I think it's a really great way of working.
I think this is also a good time to mention that there is an official Linux Voice IRC channel. That's on irc.freenode.net /Linux Voice. And there are usually about 30, 35 people around. Sometimes there's not much going on. Sometimes there's some pretty cool conversations. So everybody join. And if you're bored at work or you don't like your job, then simply join our chat channel and complain about your job.
Is it official?
I think it's officially unofficial, I guess because it's hosted on Freenode. Oh, I don't know. But,
it was started by Alan Pope, so it's Alan Pope's official Linux Voice channel.
So is it sponsored by Canonical?
That's it. They are our finds.
You did it, Graham. You did it.
Well done, Graham.
Oh, thanks. I'm genuinely sorry.
So that's the halfway reminder, and it is roughly at halfway, and it brings us to the halfway point where we are 50% of the way through this fine podcast. Still to come, there's the voice of the masses, and there's the other thing.
There isn't. Is there are no neurons.
That's it.
So we probably actually are about 75% of the way through now.
God, all those good intentions just ruined. We can use this little hiatus to remind people that you can go to Barnes & Noble or WH Smith's or even some branches of Sainsbury's and buy Linux Voice on the newsstand. But we're not sure which exactly Sainsbury's stock us or which WH Smith's indeed.
Aren't we in no Sainsbury's for the next week or two?
Are we? Oh, and then we're in...
We re-enter them.
We go back into Sainsbury's after a while. Ah, it's just so weird, isn't it? But
Ireland have more copies.
Yeah, that's right. Eason's asked for a big increase in the number of copies that they had. So, Irish people, you'll be able to read more Linux Voice wherever you are in Ireland.
I think it's fair to say then, if given the fact that it's in all sorts of different supermarkets and moving around between them, if you can't find it, buy a subscription. It's cheaper. You get your issues more timely, and of course, you contribute back to the free software community because we are the only magazine that gives 50% of our profits back.
I might share some insight in the world of magazine distribution to our listeners in that I don't think magazines dying are entirely down to magazines. I think it's partly down to this incredibly antiquated system that seems to change from one month to the next on how and where magazines are sold. We're still getting our heads around it.
Right, that brings us on to the voice of the masses then, in which we asked something about Linux, I guess. That's normally it. Oh, that was it, yes. Do you refer to free software as free software or as floss or as open source? Do these terms confuse or do they educate and enlighten? What's the deal with Richard Stallman getting angry with people who don't use the term floss? What about Libre? How helpful is it to refer to free software as Libre software? And all of that stuff. 24 comments as of the last time I checked on the Voice of the Masses comment section. All of which slightly different and subtly different in their interpretations of the question and the answer. And so, as always, well worth a read. Chaps, first of all, Ben.
Yes.
Open source or free software?
I vary, I have to be honest. In fact, I very rarely call it free software because although I appreciate it and I agree with the philosophy behind it, it's just a confusing term for it. Open source, I use that quite a bit because it's clearest, I think, as to what you're describing. And I use FOSS and FLOSS sometimes as well. If I'm with a technical audience who understand the terms, I use FOSS or FLOSS usually. And if I'm with non-technical people, I usually say open source.
That's pretty much what John the Nice Guy says, who reckons it depends. In speech, I use free software if I'm talking to someone I know understands the difference, or open source if they don't. In presentations, I use Floss and then explain it once. In documents, it's always open source because people don't read footnotes. And then he adds, on a side note, I once suggested to Matt Lee, the Free Software Foundation campaigns manager at the time, that perhaps they should have gone with Freedomware, a la Shareware, and his response was, it's a bit late for that. True. It does depend on the audience.
So the only term of it that I don't like is Libra. It's such a, for an English speaker, it just feels an ugly word to me, Libra. And no one knows what it means. It's a terrible name. It's a wonderful piece of software, but it's a terrible name. And as much as it means, when I first heard it, the only sort of thing, it's like, is that French for book? That was the only connection there was in my head, and it just confused me horribly.
Where did that video come from that somebody put up on the aforementioned BIP IRC thing about LibreOffice? It was a big bunch of Americans struggling to say the word LibreOffice.
Oh, yes, I remember, yeah.
And the conclusion being that we should keep spending money on Microsoft Office.
That's QuickOffice, I think it was.
QuickOffice, right. So LibreOffice, hard to say.
Yes, they bought the free office domain name or something like that, haven't they? The QuickOffice people. Just to muddy the waters even further.
Right. Thanks. And is that also free software?
No, it's not.
QuickOffice.
It's a marketing campaign.
Damn. Oh, well.
Well, you know, I interviewed Richard Stallman a few years ago, and I did ask him, how do you feel about the fact that free software is an ambiguous term? And would you have considered something like Libra, even though I don't particularly like that, think the word works that well? And he said something very similar, that it's too late to change it now. You know, they've been battling this campaign for a while. So I think even RMS accepts that it's free software is a fuddly term, and it can get mixed up with crappy Windows freeware and stuff. So
that's such a massive cop-out of an answer. You're asking him for his opinion, and he comes back with, well, it's too late. That's like a Newsnight answer. That's a Diddy threat to overrule him.
In fairness, Richard Solomon does tend to give pretty good answers, pretty direct answers, let's say. So, you know, normally he's not afraid of speaking his mind, so we won't
beat him up for that one. Speaking of Stallman, Joe Ressington says, I find it funny that Stallman and co. call GPL software free when it has usage restrictions. Only software that's in the public domain is truly free. That said, being able to see the source code of a project doesn't mean that you are free to do anything with it. Just look at TrueCrypt. In that sense, it's far better to have the relative freedom of the GPL. Hooray for Stallman.
And I think there is some ambiguity in the term open source, because to me, open source only applies to stuff that you do have the freedom to modify and redistribute. Whereas some people use it like the Microsoft source license.
That's where the ambiguity
comes. Horrible stuff like that. Yeah.
I think it's a bit of a marketing strategy, isn't it? And the path of least resistance usually works best. This is almost the same thing as the Pirate Party being encumbered with the name Pirate Party.
Stupid name.
Open source for all of us who do any coding at all is easily understandable, and maybe something like the capitalization of the O and the S would have been enough to have actually. Okay, so they're talking about the ratified free licenses that we're just talking about. When I usually say open source, but if I'm writing, I'll often say open source and free software just to make the distinction.
Just to do it the other way around for everyone else.
I like to give credit to the Free Software Foundation and to the GPL, you know, in what they're trying to do, and the fact that there is a distinction, you've got to be careful.
Okay, after we've criticised the word Libra for being all funny and foreign, and suspiciously French-sounding, David, Zida, Sultan of Swing, and Benz all recommend Libra. As an example, David says, I use the term free software as I support the positions taken by the FSF. but I do accept that Libra Software might have been a better and less prone to misinterpretation name. Open source software does indeed miss the point and doesn't do anything to protect users' rights or to further an aim of having less need for proprietary software. However, open source... Andrew Bowden says, I always use open source. As for the reason, well, I guess there's going to be a few people like me out there with this answer. I haven't really got any reason at all, other than that I heard the term open source first and it's been lodged in my mind ever since.
A bit like the word discovery, then. Yeah.
A bit like the word discovery. And Eric Duhamel says, I've used the terms interchangeably depending on context. I was using free software more often, but in many cases, open source is more descriptive and prompts more of the right questions. Mm. Yes, I agree with that completely.
And also, I think, sorry, Mike, I was just going to say that when I am talking to people that don't know, it's probably much more useful to just explain, as I think everyone said, to actually just take a moment to explain why it's important and what's important about the terms.
True, it doesn't take long.
What about freedom software? How would that sound?
Like freedom fries.
Yeah, like freedom fries. It's patriotic. If you don't like freedom software, then you stand for what we don't
tyranny.
Stand for.
The yeah. software of tyranny.
If you're not...
Yeah. Exactly. Fool me once and, well, is that your phone, Graham?
There's somebody at the door.
Ooh.
How exciting. That gives us the opportunity to... Well, we had the opportunity already when Graham was there. Kevin O'Brien says, I will use free software when possible, then open source. I think the license is important. The GPL is the only license that tries to protect my freedom as a user. That is why it is my first choice. Yes, the GPL is massively important. With the word free is used as an example in the appendices to 1984 when George Orwell's talking about doublespeak, newspeak, that's it, and how the... In the future, in the far future of 1984, in Airstrip 1, the sentence, this man is free, will have no logical meaning at all, because the word freedom has been replaced, and therefore the concept is eroded of political or religious freedom. And, you know, what would Orwell say to all those lazy buggers out there just using the word open source because they can't be bothered to explain the concepts of free beer and free speech? He'd be jolly dismayed.
That's a very good point.
And in that spirit of rebuke, I come to Hjauj and Rakios. Hjauj says, I never really know these days what the difference is, and quite frankly don't really care. I use what works. If there's a choice, I use something with as free a license as possible, but only if it costs nothing. I use NVIDIA drivers because my machine works better with them. If the Nuvo drivers work better, I'd use them. It's the same with pretty much every piece of software I own. And Rakios, I'm with Hjauj on this. Again, mentioning the NVIDIA drivers. I'm also with them on this. I just use it because it works. Sorry, George.
Are you saying that because you're speaking into your telly speak? What's it called?
The telly screen.
Telly screen.
Yeah, it's downstairs. It can't hear me. I know. What's that behind the corkboard? We are the dead.
Reborn.
I think. There's also further ambiguity with free software, and sometimes I'm not entirely sure whether some I'm talking about is genuinely free software, because it's stuff like it's the Debian situation, really.
Ah, yeah.
So I'm using Ubuntu. If I install, say, Firefox or LibreOffice on Ubuntu, is that free software? Because it is, you know, it's released under a free license, but according to the FSF, it comes bundled with an OS that allows you to install non-free software. Does it then get tainted and become non-free but open source software?
I think that's a bit extreme, to be honest. I think free software that enables you to install non-free software does not become non-free just by making it easy to do what you want.
But that's the FSF's position.
Well, I disagree with the FSF's position. I think it's impractical. And I don't think it furthers the long-term goals of spreading free software either. If you have people who are doing a really, really good job, like the Debian project, and then you say that you saw them dancing in the woods with Goody Proctor, then you're just standing in the way of what they want to achieve, which is getting Linux and getting free software out there.
Yeah, I mean, I know I've said this quite a few times in the past, but I think it's a pragmatic thing. There's a reason why we want to say open source, and there's a reason why we want to say free software, and that's to get these ideas out and to get people thinking about how they use software and how they use computers and what the end results actually are. The end results being that we all have more freedom to do what we want. And as long as people were progressively getting those more freedoms, which we are, looking at things like the Raspberry Pi and the change in the UK IT curriculum, you know, and it's having an effect across the globe, then it we're going in the right direction. And maybe these kind of conversations will become less important.
That's the end of my LibreOffice doc, in which I have summarized what people said on that there Voice of the Masses thread. But do please go back and read it, because everyone's just got... Because English is so awesome, some would say rubbish.
Proprietary.
Words have all got slightly different nuances and meanings, and every single person on there has picked up a slightly different edge, different facet to the argument, and that's what makes it great and worth talking about, rather than the usual, is this the year of Linux on the desktop nonsense.
I wonder if one of those sort of made-up languages like Esperanto or Interglossia or even Klingon, I wonder if they've solved this problem and they have a word that sums up exactly that sort of Stallman-style freedom, freedom of sharing community. That's something to find out.
That should be a challenge. Learn Esperanto. Well volunteered, Mike.
Oops. See you in 6 months.
Before we move on, can I pose a question to you guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
If you were to go back to the starting of it all, you're sat in the MIT AI lab with Stallman, what word would you say he should use?
Freedom.
Freedomware.
Freedom software, yeah.
That's a tough question.
I think I'd go with Mike. I think I'd say freedomware.
Freedomware, that just sounds okay.
Sounds very American.
I think freedomware works. I mean, this is before the invention of the word free, before all those ridiculous eagle posters, you know. oh dear me! Sorry, I've got sidetracked there. But no, I think in 1980, whenever it was, 84, 82, was it 84? The word freedom didn't have so many, you know, ridiculous kids in Afghan villages getting blown up connotations.
Was it not freedom versus communism then?
Or
did they not use it in that?
I don't know. But if you put free software onto the coattails of an anti-communistic campaign, then it wouldn't have been tagged with the communist socialist labels that it has, which would be a double win.
Maybe we should, it should be democratic software.
Demosoft. Well, no.
it's got to be something from Greek or Latin, hasn't it?
I do.
Just to make it sound more awesome.
In many ways, I like the way that GNU is a kind of an abstraction of those ideas and a made-up word that kind of stands out in conversation because there's no ambiguity about it.
Yeah, even though the word itself means nothing.
Yeah, it's a word that once you're familiar with its meaning, you immediately, there's no confusion.
I was in Salzburg the other day with some friends, and we saw some gnomes in someone's garden, and I kept saying gnome, because I hadn't said gnome for years. I just never talk about gnomes, sorry. So my friends was wondering, why do I keep saying gnome all the time? It's just natural to me now.
So, Graham, would FOSS or FLOSS sort of fit your view? It's a new word that doesn't have a...
I don't really like FLOSS. I think FOSS is just easier to say and rolls off the tongue quicker. And there's the Libre issue, which I do kind of agree with everyone. Libre is, to many people, most people won't understand what Libre is. And when you have to explain something on top of explaining something else...
And it's just the br sound at the end. It just doesn't flow as a word.
Yeah.
I think this could be one for our readers to our listeners to let us know in the comments. What word would you recommend, listeners? We could even send a list to Richard Stallman and see what he says.
That I think that pretty much brings Voice of the Masses to an end. So it's now time for our impromptu tribute to Rick Mayall. Woof!
This is books.
Does someone have to get hit in the nuts?
Yeah. Why don't you fire your Nerf gun into your own nuts?
I don't know if the webcam can handle it while streaming Hangouts. I'll try starting it, see what happens. I'll just check it's loaded.
What listeners may not know is that Ben really is working on a Nerf gun that tracks your face and shoots you.
I can't wait for that. That's going to be awesome.
This is going to be a
Does that mean feature. Ben has to draw a face onto his nuts for it to work?
I've done it by angling the camera slightly higher so it tracks your face, but obviously the gun's pointed lower. It's not perfect. It's a bit of a hack. No, it can't pick up the camera while it's also being used.
Sorry, Rick. Still, at least the software we're using is free, unlike Britain under Thatcher's military junta.
I guess that's it then.
That's it.
On that bombshell.
Yeah.
Au revoir. I mean, oh no.
I think mostly it's worked quite well. It's quite surreal watching you lot in a web browser.
Yeah, listeners, this is the first time we've ever recorded a podcast where we're all in a separate place. We've done it before where one or two of us have joined in via webcam, but we are all scattered across the United Kingdom and Oberbayern. So, yes, we hope it's actually worked.
What I might try and do is, you know, recreate this massive kind of Mines of Moria reverb space and put us all in the four corners of the mine.
Cool. Wow.
Anyway, I guess that's it.
Yes.
Then.
Yes.
Okay,
bye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.
Bye. Bye. It's such a nice day to be on Wednesday.